This podcast is brought to you by the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health, ACAM for short. You can find more podcasts and other resources on our website, www.acamh.org, and follow us on social media by searching ACAMH.
Hello, welcome to the In Conversation podcast series for the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health, or ACAM for short. I'm Jo Carlo, a freelance journalist with a specialism in psychology. Today I'm interviewing consultant clinical psychologist Dr. Andrew Beck of East Lancashire Child and Adolescent Services. Andrew is also president-elect of the British Association for Behavioural and Cognitive Psychotherapies. If you're a fan of our In Conversation series, please subscribe on iTunes or your preferred streaming platform. Let us know how we did with a rating or review, and do share with friends and colleagues. Andrew, thanks for joining me. Can you start by saying a little about yourself by way of an introduction?
Yeah, I'm a clinical psychologist. I work in a core CAMHS team in East Lancashire. I worked in Manchester and Tower Hamlets before that. I'm head of psychology there. My specialism's in cognitive behaviour therapy, though draw on systemic ideas as well. And also got an interest in working with children who have neurodevelopmental problems. As you said, I'm president-elect of the BABCP, so I've been president-elect for the past year. I've been a BABCP member for a long time. And this July, I'll become the president for 2 years.
You've worked with children and adolescents for around 30 years, I believe. What prompted your interest in child and adolescent mental health?
Yeah, that's a good question. I kind of fell into it, really. And I was around 19 years of age, had left school without any real qualifications, started doing some voluntary work, kind of got pulled into applying for a job in a children's home then. Found it really interesting and stimulating, but wanted to have a more of an idea about how to help some of the young people that I was working with in the kids' home, and ended up going and doing a psychology degree. And through that, got interested in research and then eventually trained as a clinical psychologist, and always kind of maintained that interest in working with children throughout my training period and then after qualification.
And you've been in CAM since 2003. And what changes have you seen within CAMHS in that time?
I mean, it's been a fantastic time to be in CAMHS, to be honest. So I first started working in CAMHS around the time when there began to be a real sea change in terms of investment in child mental health. And so I was lucky enough to be around during that first wave of teams expanding, both in terms of the numbers of staff, but also expanding the range of therapies that they could offer, getting earlier assessments for children and adolescents, and then the move towards sort of adolescent specialty teams. And it was an absolutely fantastic time. And there were sort of several years of year-on-year expansions, a real increase in the range of therapies on offer, an increase in our depth of understanding of child mental health. And I'm really lucky to have been involved in the second wave of that with the CYPI APT program, which I think has done a lot to improve the range of therapies on offer, really skill up staff. There are a lot of really good staff in CAMHS, but hadn't had access to a lot of therapeutic training, and CYPI APT's really done that. And then this new wave of the mental health in schools programs, which is, again, increasing access, increasing the availability of evidence-based therapies for children and young people. So it's been a fantastic time, really, to be involved in CAMHS and to be interested in therapies in CAMHS.
What changes, though, would you still need to happen, say, in terms of helping clinicians better connect with their clients?
Yeah, that's a really good question, Jo. All the evidence that we see from the small-scale studies that have been done suggest that kids from ethnic minority backgrounds are less likely to get referred to CAMHS, whether that's for neurodevelopmental assessments or for treatment of mental health problems. And I think one of the big challenges over the next few years is making sure that we give as good a service to our ethnic minority populations in the UK as we do to white majority service units. And I think there's really a long way to go in terms of that. We need to diversify our workforce and have workforces that look like the communities that we serve, and then train existing staff in cross-cultural assessment and treatment. So I think that's the biggest challenge now. We're getting good evidence-based treatments in place, but we need to make sure that they're available to all the communities that we work with. And I think that change has got to really come from commissioners, because services are under a lot of pressure. Even despite the big investment, services still don't have the resources to treat the need that they currently have. That's mm-hmm. why we see long waiting lists, children getting kind of suboptimal amounts of treatment and therapy. So, of course, it's really difficult for services in that situation to then step up and want to bring more people through the service. So actually what we need is for commissioners to take a kind of long, hard look at the local data to see what's going on in CAMHS teams in terms of the ethnicities of people who are coming through, and then to specifically ask CAMHS services to improve the degree to which they work with local communities and bring those local communities through for treatments.
Andrew, as we mentioned at the start, you're an accredited CBT therapist and supervisor, and you've developed many CBT training courses. Why is CBT your intervention of choice?
I think the first supervisor I ever had as a trainee was a cognitive behaviour therapist. So I think the first time I sat down in a room to learn how to be a therapist was using that approach. I suppose we do tend to prefer the things that we're first inspired by. But what I liked about it was that it was pragmatic. It was fairly short term. It focused on service user goals and looked to make changes that service users had identified as the ones they wanted to make. And then as I became kind of more interested in research evidence, it was clear that there was a good solid evidence base supporting CBT. For a wide range of problems. Now, I would add a caveat to that, though, and that's that when you bring that kind of those skills and interests into CAMHS, you need to think systemically as well. And so although CBT is my main model of orientation, I think it's got a lot to offer in a child mental health setting. We can't ignore the systems around a child and their culture and their context. So it's, in a way, I think if you're working in CAMHS, you'll often find yourself doing CBT plus, and the plus is taken into account and thinking about all those other things that impact on a child's life. But it's not to say that I don't really value other therapeutic models. And one of the things I like about working in CAMHS is that you're part of an MDT and you'll work with systemic practitioners, you'll work with art and play therapists, you'll work with people who are trained in interpersonal therapy. And I think all those models also have a lot to offer us in terms of our thinking about child mental health and how we can help particular children who are struggling.
Andrew, you developed the first standalone CBT training course in India. I'm curious about this. How did this come about?
It was really fantastic opportunity for me. I'd been involved in CBT training in England, through the IAP program mainly. Some kind of colleagues in India who I kind of knew socially as much as anything else were really interested in setting up a CBT training course in Chennai in Tamil Nadu. Now, there'd already been a really good CBT training program in Bangalore through NIMANS, which is that's a national CBT training program, but only a small number of people were able to access that, and they had to be part of the faculty there to get onto that really high quality CBT training course. So what people wanted was something that people who weren't part of that network could access. So we worked with Care International, which is a training provider in Chennai and the University of Chennai, to get a short course that was modular. So people, myself or some colleagues from the UK, could go for a week at a time and train people up into the various modules and help develop the skill set over there. When I present a model, so we might do a couple of days training on OCD, for example, what the team did who would come on the training is think about how could they apply this in their own setting. So they did a lot of the adaptation themselves so that the specialists in child mental health who came along would work together as sort of mini teams as part of the training to think about how they'd adapt those ideas in the schools or in the hospitals that they worked in. And likewise, the people from an adult specialist would think about adapting it for their context and do a lot of the work around cultural adaptation as part of the training as they thought about these ideas and thought about how to apply them. And likewise, people working with children would think about, well, how do we take these ideas down the developmental spectrum? You know, how do we work with kids at different ages in our context to make them applicable? Now, what's really nice about that course is that I don't go over there and do the CBT training anymore, because some of the people who did it early on are now more than capable of running courses themselves. So it's been great that for a relatively small investment in time from people from the UK who had CBT expertise, we've now got a really good group of therapists and trainers and supervisors in India who've been able to develop their own courses and get them up and running. So it was really good for me to be involved with that. I learned a lot about cross-cultural working. I was working with some of the brightest and the best mental health practitioners in India. You know, we had psychologists, psychiatrists, nurses, social workers come in. I gained probably a lot more from that than I gave really as a trainer. It really helped develop my own thinking, and it's great to see that it's got a life of its own now.
Did you bring back some ideas as well as those that you disseminated?
Yeah, well, I did. And I think if I'd not gone over there and spent all that time thinking about cross-cultural adaptation, I would never have ended up writing the book that I did on transcultural CBT. So although that was written for English or, you know, kind of British practitioners, the inspiration to write it came from me having to really work hard with my Indian colleagues to think about how those ideas developed in a Western context fit across different cultures. So, yeah, I got a lot from that work and brought a lot back in terms of my own thinking.
We're speaking during the 2020 COVID-19 pandemic, and I know you've advocated behavioural activation as helpful in improving the mood of children and families during the pandemic. Can you share some of the key principles of this and why it's particularly useful at this time?
Yeah, it will be a pleasure. So, I mean, when I train in CBT, the model I used was very much cognitive and behaviour therapy for kind of childhood depression. But about 5 years ago, I was lucky to attend some training that Professor Shirley Reynolds offered on using brief behavioural activation for depression, and became very inspired by that and very interested in this sort of evidence-based approach to treating adolescent depression. And when the pandemic started in the UK and a couple of days after lockdown, I started thinking, well, I've got kids. I've got a 10-year-old and a 14-year-old kid. They're likely to be at home for weeks, if not months. And it has turned out to be months. What can I bring from my own kind of psychologically informed knowledge about child mental health that's going to be helpful at home? And so I looked to the work that Shirley and people like Chris Martell had done on behavioural activation as a framework for that. And although that was developed for children who are depressed, I thought it had a lot to offer just in thinking about time spent with kids in general. And so what BA suggests really at heart is that all of our moods are improved by the things that we do, by the way that we spend our time. And one way that BA thinks about the activities we might do is to think about, it uses this acronym ACE, A-C-E. So in any particular task that we do, does it give us a sense of achievement? Does it give us closeness to others? And does it give us enjoyment? And so what you can do is think about how you spend your day and think about the tasks that you do or the activities that you do during the course of that day, and ask, does this give me a good mix of achievement, closeness, and enjoyment? So an example of that might be, let's say I've got a big pile of washing that needs folding and putting away. So I could do that and it would give me a personally quite high sense of achievement. It's one of those things I kind of quite like doing. But if I did it on my own, it wouldn't give me much closeness to others. I might get a moderate sense of enjoyment, but not a great deal. So you could think, well, if I'm going to spend an hour doing that this morning, it'll have a slightly beneficial effect on my mood. But how about I got one of my children to do it with me so that as we do it, we can talk? And how about I get them to pick the music we're going to listen to while we do it? And we can chat about the music while we're doing it, and both of us might enjoy that. So although I've got a task that might give me a sense of achievement to start with, I could actually add some additional closeness and enjoyment to make that a genuinely mood-boosting task for both of us. And I think if you're looking at long periods of time with your children being sort of not occupied with school and not seeing their friends in the way that they would have done previously, using that way to plan the days, to make sure that there's a good mix for you and them of ACE activities, make sure that they are getting closeness to other people, that there are some really enjoyable either individual or family-based activities planned in, and to make sure people do get a sense of achievement is a good way of keeping everybody's mood kind of going, really, and everybody's mood well, whether they someone who has been depressed and is vulnerable to depression, or someone who's just dealing with the pandemic. But I've got a couple of things I'd like to add to that as kind of caveats. I think it's a really useful model, but something I've noticed as the pandemic's gone on is that even as a parent who takes those kind of things seriously, it's been tough to maintain them, and there've been days and sometimes days at a time when our family activities have kind of slipped a little bit, and I think all of our well-being has suffered then when we've fallen out of regular routines a bit, when perhaps bedtimes have got later, family members have slept in a bit more, not spent as much quality time together. And I do really appreciate how hard it is to sustain that over months and months at a time. And yeah, for most of us, we're going to be sustaining it right the way through till September.
Is it something in terms of using this idea of ACE? Should parents explain the concept to their children?
I mean, I always like to approach family dilemmas as collaboratively as possible. So I think most children from 9, 10, 11 upwards would be able to get that idea of ACE activities. And I think if parents sit down and explain it in a developmentally accessible way, most kids would get that and understand the need to plan days a little bit. Now, it's interesting. I think when I first, I started writing something on, I think, like the second day of the lockdown. And I think I was a bit overambitious then, in that I was thinking, well, maybe we should plan a week at a time. And, that was the best way to do it. And actually, I've been putting this into practice with my own family, but also with the families that I work with as a CAMHS practitioner. And I've kind of changed my mind a bit about that now. And I think if you're planning one or two days ahead, you're doing pretty well. And that's probably a realistic amount of planning most families can do. And the other thing that I've really noticed in doing this work through the lockdown is, obviously I kind of wrote that outline and came up with my ideas from a pretty privileged position. You know, I live in a big house. We've got both myself and my partner are working. We've got money. We've got space. We've got resources to draw on. And one of the things that's really struck me during lockdown is how much you've got to think about bringing these ideas into play with families who are really struggling, who are living in very crowded accommodation, who don't have a lot of money, don't have a lot of resources, parents who are perhaps struggling quite a bit themselves with mental health difficulties or financial pressures or even substance misuse problems. And I think in those kind of contexts, you've got to be quite modest about how much you can plan and what would be considered to be a good day. But I still think that there's something to be gained from that model, even with families who are really struggling, to sort of plan some pleasant, enjoyable activities that bring a sense of closeness and bring a sense of achievement into people's days.
So where might one start if a family is in that situation where there isn't money coming in where the conditions are cramped and there are lots of stressors? If one wanted to bring in that idea of ACE, how could one do that in a fairly modest way when there just aren't the kind of resources that perhaps you have?
I mean, it's a really good question, Joe. I think one of the things is to introduce the idea and just start off by asking parents and their child, if they're kind of on the in the consultation as well, to think about one thing they could change the next day that might just boost everybody's mood. And because families are incredibly resourceful, and I tend to think that families who don't have a great deal have learned to be pretty resourceful and will be able to come up with some solutions that as a therapist, particularly one like me from who's in a privileged situation these days, that I would struggle to come up with. So I think having a facilitative discussion with families and getting them to reflect and getting them to think about just one thing that they might that they might manage that next day is a really good step. Mm-hmm. And you may need to scaffold that a bit by saying, okay, so what might be the barriers? What might get in the way of you doing it? Is there anything I can do to help make that happen? I've also found, I mean, one of the really nice things about lockdown for me as a therapist is it's got me more used to keeping regular contact with families through text, for example, which a lot of services were a bit funny about historically. But I could then, the next day, when we've made a modest plan for one thing they might do, just text and say, how did it go? What did you notice about how it impacted on everybody in terms of how you were getting on or your mood? What could you do this afternoon that might build on that? Or what could you add tomorrow, given what you've learned about doing this, that might just make life a little bit better then? So I think setting out with fairly modest aims, scaffolding discussions, and then even kind of following up a little bit the next day with a text reminder and a prompt might just help families to make a shift in a way that they find genuinely helpful.
You're implying from that families do still have contact with CAMHS, and I wanted to ask you about that. But what impact has the pandemic had on CAMHS?
I think families who are already in the service, on the whole, are my experience both within my own service and speaking to colleagues in other CAMHS services, is that despite a lot of care moving to remote care, either through video platforms or the phone, that families who are already in the service are carrying on getting that. I think some therapists have adapted to remote working better than others, but certainly a lot of therapists have really risen to that challenge in CAMHS and drawn on a lot of the resources that are around on how to adapt your therapy for remote working and offered a good service. But my worry is that nationally, the amount of referrals to CAMHS has gone down. And I don't think that's because the need has gone down. I mean, there'll probably be a few kids who are struggling a bit less because school was a problem. And when you take school out of the picture, those kids may not need a CAMHS referral as urgently as before. But equally, there's probably as many children for whom school is a massively beneficial place and has actually positively helped their mental health. So I'm not sure that the absence of school explains the reduction in referrals. I think it's just families are a bit reluctant to contact their GP or other people who might have referred them to CAMHS and who are sitting on problems and struggling with them and not reaching out and getting the help that they might typically have got. My expectation is, and I think a lot of services are gearing up for the idea that as the lockdown eases, probably September time, that we'll see a massive increase in referrals into CAMHS as those families then begin to seek the help that they need. And also the children who are likely to struggle to return to school after a long break will need CAMHS input as well. I mean, we're lucky in the Northwest where I work in that we're one of the trailblazers for the mental health in schools initiatives. So we've got a lot of staff currently in training and working into schools who will be able to pick up a lot of that work in September. But I know that not every region has benefited from that so far. The idea is that everywhere in England will get that investment eventually. So I think CAMHS services that have got those partnerships into schools will probably manage, but it is going to bring additional pressures onto other services.
I mean, I'm wondering if the pandemic might be an opportunity for better investment in child and adolescent mental health services. What do you feel? Are you optimistic?
Before the pandemic, there was this big investment in the mental health in schools program anyway. So it's been one of the few areas of the NHS where I think there's been a genuine investment in spend rather than just, you know, not even keeping up with the pace of inflation. So I do think that investment was already happening and will continue to happen as it's rolled out in different regions. I'd be really surprised if the core financial packaging to CAMHS increases significantly. I read some estimates that at current funding levels, we can meet somewhere between 35% and 40% of the need in the population. The schools projects will increase that a little bit, but I think we'll always be somewhat underfunded for the tasks that we're doing. What I think may improve, though, and genuinely improve as a result of the pandemic, is that we've had to quite rapidly learn to work more flexibly as CAMS services. Mm-hmm. And so services that might, for example, have really been reluctant to offer phone or video-based appointments are now doing that as a matter of course. Mm-hmm. Services that might have been a bit reluctant to move to electronic patient records suddenly find that there's a huge drive to do that, because then staff can access records from home and provide a much better remote service. So I do think, and I really hope that as CAM services, we've learned to be more flexible, and that some of that flexibility will remain in the service after lockdown ends, to the benefit of our families. Because for some families, I think this is the case in a lot of regions, getting to a CAMS appointment is really tough. Okay, you know, you may have to take two buses to travel to a hospital. That might cost £10 for a family of two or three, which is a lot if you're struggling financially. And so being able to more readily offer remote appointments might really benefit families in terms of access. So I do think we should see some genuine improvements in the service that we offer. You know, I usually would happily, you know, have sort of six appointments on a day, and really feel energized by those, and the move to be more creative and flexible and offer those as remote appointments has been pretty tiring. And it took a lot of getting used to, but probably 3 months in, I'm finding it less tiring, and genuinely think I'm beginning to offer as good a service now as a remote therapist and a remote supervisor as I did in the room 4 months ago.
Is there a sort of self-care element then for practitioners?
Yeah, that's a really good question. You know, I think as practitioners, we're generally pretty awful at that, aren't we? And a lot of the online resources around the move to remote working and the move to remote supervision have taken that into account and emphasised that need for self-care as a practitioner, but also if you're a supervisor, for thinking about the well-being of the people that you're supervising who are working remotely. So I just give a quick plug for there's a podcast and a document that Professor Sarah Corrie and I did for BABCP, which is available for non-members on our website, around supervision during the pandemic. And we really emphasize that need for kind of looking after the emotional well-being of staff as an important part of that move to remote supervision, so that as a supervisor, you're asking about it, you're thinking about it, and you're acknowledging those additional challenges that come. Because if we've got an emotionally healthy workforce, we're going to have a better workforce in terms of patient outcomes. People look on BABCP as a Google search term, and then there's a whole set of pages on COVID resources, and you'll find the supervision resources there, and you'll be able to find a link to the podcast too that Lucy Maddox did.
Andrew, what else is in the pipeline for you that you'd like to mention?
Oh, well, I mean, taking over the presidency of BABCP, really, and I'm taking over from Paul Sikorskis, who, if I'm sure everybody who's worked in child mental health will know about Paul's work. He's a pretty tough act to follow, to be honest. He's an absolute remarkable figure in terms of mental health, and has been one of the genuine pioneers in terms of improving CBT as a trainer, as a supervisor, as a researcher, but also has done tons in the organisation around improving the way that we think about diversity in the way that we offer therapy. So the big thing in the pipeline for me is stepping up into that role, continuing the really good work that Paul's done around diversity. And of course, this is something that all organisations need to be thinking more about at the minute. And one of the really positive things I think that's come out of the Black Lives Matters campaign in the UK is it's put all organisations under the spotlight in terms of how they think about equality and diversity. And I think that's absolutely for the best, that there is more scrutiny. And so as BABCP, we've made a good start around that, but I think there's more work to be done. What that probably means for me is that more opportunities to train people on this topic. For the past few years since the book came out, I've had a lot of done a lot of training for organisations around improving how people provide therapies to diverse communities. So probably do some more of that. So certainly one of the things that that I'd like to see over the next few years is I think there's a lot of shared interests between ACAM members and BABCP members. And we've had a really good history in the past of joint training events where our child and family special interest group have come together with ACAM to put on some joint CPD. And I would really like to see, over the next couple of years, to see that happening again, because I think, our organizations do have a lot in common. And, there are many people who are members of both organizations or who are members of one, but keep a close eye on what the other's doing because they see the value of what that organization offers. So I think I'd really like to see that. Personally, I think, the big challenge for me is, I can't see this sort of world of COVID changing a lot over the next year or two. So it's continuing to think about how you can make family life genuinely enjoyable during these constraints.
Finally, Andrew, what is your takeaway message for those listening to our conversation?
Well, in terms of child mental health, it's that, you know, I think that provision of evidence-based treatments is immensely helpful, and we're moving towards getting those treatments more widely available. But there's still a long way to go, and that includes working with our minority communities to make sure that their mental health needs are met, because historically I think they've been very poorly served. But also thinking about the challenge to come around the ending the pandemic lockdown and the return of children to school, and looking after the mental health needs of kids who've been very isolated for quite a long time now, and who may need additional support to get back to the challenges of being at school, or who may have had mental health needs that just haven't been met because it's been difficult for parents to get to speak to GPs and get referrals made. So I think there is a fair task to do in meeting lots of unmet needs, but we do have a pretty good idea about what's going to help, and we've got skilled mental health practitioners both in CAMHS, third sector, and in schools who can rise to that challenge. So I think that's what I'd like people to take away from today.
Great. Thank you, Andrew. Thank you so much. It's really interesting. For more details on Dr. Andrew Beck, please visit the ACAM website, www.acam.org, and Twitter at ACAM. ACAM is spelled A-C-A-M-H. And don't forget to follow us on iTunes or your preferred streaming platform. And let us know if you enjoyed the podcast with a rating or review. And do share with friends and colleagues.
This podcast was brought to you by the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health, ACAM for short.